The Chase National Bank was one of the worst offenders. That is why a lot of people in Washington, Moscow, and the world at large are watching to see whether history will repeat. That is why the evidence unearthed from the secret files of German alien property custodian Caesar is so significant. It indicates that even during the present war, the Paris branches of Chase and J.P. Morgan were quite willing and anxious to do business with the Germans, though British banks were more so. Dr. Caesar testified that, quote, the protection afforded to Chase was justified on the grounds that it had been active on behalf of Germany before the war in such matters as the German standstill credit negotiations. The British banks, he said, were even more preferred by the Germans than the branches of Chase and Morgan's. The German occupying authorities decreed that the British and Canadian banks in the occupied zone of France, quote, shall no longer be considered as enemy banks, unquote. These branches provided long-term credits to assist the German war machine. But especially significant were some of the letters found in Dr. Caesar's files. One indicated that the J.P. Morgan and Company had gone out of its way to curry favor with the Nazis by showing that the Morgans had nothing to do with Jews. One memo sent to American banking czar Caesar by Mr. Decestre, L-E-C-E-S-T-R-E, a high official of the Morgan firm, read, on the attached sheet, there is represented some information relative to the predecessors of Mr. J.P. Morgan, actual head of J.P. Morgan and Company Incorporated, New York. Following the tradition of his father, Mr. Morgan never admitted Jews as associates or fellow workers. The Morgan House has been frequently found in its business in opposition to the great Jewish banking houses in the United States, such as Kuhn, Loeb & Company. As to Morgan & C. Paris, the personnel since the foundation of the bank in 1868 has never included a Jew. This memo is dated January 15, 1943, more than a year after Germany declared war on the United States. Listeners wishing to learn more about some of the archive shows, such as the Radio Free America shows 1, 2, and 10, and Uncle Sam and the Swastika, are referred to a tape duplication service called Spitfire, going live. That, by the way, the roots of the Cold War, a For the Record segment from September of 1995. That tape duplication service is called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the KFJC webpage. That's at www.kfjc.org. And there's also a version on perhaps a little more up-to-date on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The Spitfire website is equipped with real audio, so you can listen to the half-hour segments that are going out to the various stations that carry this program that week. And the KFJC webpage is also audio-equipped, so that if you know people who are outside of the KFJC signal radius, they can tune in at www.kfjc.org and listen to the program on their computers. Okay? Alrighty. What we're going to do is to get right back to the next half hour, actually the next pair of half hour segments. This is a couple of half hour segments entitled Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, which will put some of the information that you've already heard in perspective and introduce a new and pivotally important element, and one that grows directly from the set of associations that we've spoken about so far, namely the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. This next pair of, the next side is a half hour in length, followed by the second half hour segment of Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to take a look at some of the major capital flows of the 20th century, this by way of understanding or assimilating some background information to some of the recent topics that I've engaged in on this program. I suspect that some members of the listening audience may find some of my analysis concerning the Bormann Organization, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, and also the relatively obscure Nazi-tracked Serpent's Walk to be somewhat unintelligible. And by way of gaining some understanding about just how what I have termed the Underground Reich has acquired some of the tremendous capital and power that it has, we're going to take a look at some of the events that underlie the not only the growth of fascism, but the acquisition and the coalescing of that financial power. I've done numerous shows about the what I have termed the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that helped to build fascism in the first place. Some of those archive shows, by the way, available from Spitfire include Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America program number 10, the miscellaneous program Uncle Sam and Il Duce, and a number of different half-hour segments. And you can contact Spitfire for that information. What we're going to do, as I said, in the next two half-hour segments is to take a look at some of the key events in that in the operations of that transatlantic financial and industrial axis. And in particular, one could consider a hydraulic paradigm, a hydraulic model for some of the 20th century capital flows that have helped to lead to the acquisition of that power. Now, the first capital flow that we're going to look at concerns the recycling of the capital from the American boom of the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, over into Europe, because it was Europe in general, the fascist powers of Europe and Germany in particular, that were the repositories of this tremendous amount of capital that was generated in the booming America of the 1920s. And this flow is the first of the major capital flows from the United States and North America of the 1920s to Europe and Germany in particular. For our discussion of this first capital flow, and for most of the discussion this evening, we're going to take a look at a very important book still out in softcover. It's called The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. This book was authored by Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, Blowback and The Science of Coercion, both of which I've used extensively on this program before. The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, was published in softcover by Common Courage Press of Monroe, Maine, and is copyrighted 1995. You can reach Common Courage Press at Box 702, Monroe, Maine, 04951. Phone is 207-525-0900, and the fax is 207-525-3068. And as I said, what we're going to look at first concerns the capitalization of the fascist powers of Europe and Germany in particular in the 1920s. Europe, Germany was not yet fascist, but fascism was building in Europe. And in particular, not only was Europe in general and Germany in particular used as a vehicle for investment, but in particular, as we shall see, members of the American elite who wore the dual hats of captains of finance and industry and also master diplomats saw the building up of a strong anti-communist Germany and the restitution or the restoration of the German industrial elite as a bulwark against communism. Many of the Wall Street elite that we're going to look at, including people like John Foster and Alan Dulles from the pivotal Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, and people like William Draper, later Brigadier General William Draper, of Dillon Reed, a key Wall Street investment firm, had much to do with the capitalization of Germany and the capitalization of the companies that ultimately led to the rise of Nazism in Germany. And some of their cohorts and fellow associates in the State Department, such as people like Robert Murphy and William Bullitt of the Regia faction of the State Department, had much to do with shoring up this investment policy from a political and diplomatic standpoint. So we're looking at capital flows, and in particular, on the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, one should pay attention to some of the business elite, some of the financial elite, who were closely allied with some of their colleagues in the elite who were diplomats. And later on, we're going to take a look at some of the elite's participation in the intelligence community and military in order to perpetuate this relationship. Turning to The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson of the capitalization of Germany in the 1920s, the first of the major capital flows we're going to look at, we read, in confidential discussions, John Foster Dulles and the U.S. delegation, by the way, this is the U.S. delegation at the Versailles Conference, the Paris Peace Conference at the end of World War I, in confidential discussions, Dulles and the U.S. delegation placed greater stress on a second concern, the possibility of revolution or civil war in Europe. Secretary of State Lansing's comments quoted earlier concerning the, quote, terrible possibility of a proletarian despotism over Central Europe, unquote, directly argued that reparations must be kept low in order to avoid revolution. By the way, those reparations are German reparations payments after World War I. By the way, Secretary of State Lansing was a blood relative of John Foster and Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell. Continuing. The Berlin and Budapest rebellions, both eventually suppressed with considerable bloodshed, seemed to provide vivid evidence to ruling circles that there was substance to Lansing's fears. Third, and perhaps most fundamentally, Dulles and the U.S. delegation were anxious to restart the engine of commerce that had been disrupted by the war. Without a German economic recovery, Norman Davis wrote, quote, "It is impossible for the rest of Europe to get to work and be prosperous. It is most essential for the future stability of Europe that business confidence and credit be restored at the earliest possible moment, and these can never be restored as long as any large nation in Europe is struggling under a financial burden which the investors of the world think she cannot carry," unquote. Davis was not speaking simply of stability in some abstract sense, but rather of a particular type of order, one seen as sustainable by, quote, "the investors of the world," unquote. And skipping down, we're now going to look at the actual capitalization of Germany to realize this policy. And in particular, we're going to take a look at John Foster Dulles, along with his brother Alan, key partners in the Sullivan and Cromwell Wall Street law firm. Later on, we're going to look at Dillon Reed, and bear in mind the name William Draper from Dillon Reed. Returning to the splendid blonde beast about the first of these major capital flows going from North America to Germany and Europe in the 20s, John Foster Dulles had meanwhile returned to the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, where he became a full partner specializing in the legal aspects of German reparations and in international finance generally. In 1923 and 4, banker J.P. Morgan recommended Dulles to be special counsel to the Dawes Committee, which U.S. and British banks had helped establish in the hopes of finding a way out of the reparations morass. Dulles helped engineer a scheme under which U.S. and foreign banks made new loans to the Reichsbank, the German state bank, which used the funds to pay reparations to Britain, France, and other European powers, who in turn paid off their own war loans from the U.S. This financial merry-go-round generated millions of dollars in interest payments for international lenders and kept billions of dollars worth of loans current just a bit longer. How long the borrowed money could continue to revolve remained an open question, but as long as it worked, John Foster Dulles was hailed as a master of international finance. By the way, Foster Dulles and the Dawes and Young plan are discussed in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, available from Spitfire. Continuing. Meanwhile, Dulles's law firm and his major clients pioneered a roughly similar system for private U.S. investment in German finance and industry. This new network of trade relations proved to be the most important single push forward in elite U.S.-German relations prior to World War II, though of course some ties between U.S. and German businessmen can be traced back to the 19th and even the 18th century. The United States had emerged from World War I with its currency and industry stronger than ever before, at least as long as Britain and other debtors continued to pay their bills. The 1920s boom, driven by imperialism, cheap oil, and the emerging automobile economy in the U.S., created enormous pools of investment funds in the banks of New York and Boston. This led to an international financial situation that was similar in some respects to the Middle East oil crisis of the 1970s. During the 1970s crisis, the central problem from the standpoint of international finance was to recycle the massive pools of funds that had shifted to the Middle East back through the international banking network in order to stave off a string of bankruptcies that would otherwise have resulted from illiquidity in the system. During the 1970s, most of this recycling, unquote, was carried out through the Eurodollar market. During the second half of the 1920s, the most important international market for recycling the new private U.S. wealth was Germany. This investment was carried out mainly through loans to German industry, direct U.S. investment in German companies, development loans to German cities, and millions of dollars worth of Dawes Plan credits that indirectly financed German war reparations. The scope of U.S.-German capital flows during the 1920s has never been fully documented, but the fraction of it that can be traced totals close to $1.5 billion, not including Dawes Plan credits. In today's currency, this sum would be measured in the tens of billions of dollars. There was considerable direct U.S. investment in German companies, as U.S. companies sought to buy into European markets at bargain prices. AT&T purchased a half dozen German telecommunications equipment manufacturers during the late 1920s and early 1930s, while General Motors bought part of the Adam Opel Corporation, and with it about 40% of the German automotive market in 1929. Fritz Opel joined GM's board of directors as part of the deal. Ford Motor Company built a vast factory at Cologne, then used it to manufacture cars for all of Central and Eastern Europe. There were also joint ventures such as IG Farben's pact with Standard Oil of New Jersey, some of which were subsequently found to be violations of U.S. law. General Electric purchased substantial shares of the German electronics giant AEG and Siemens, entered joint ventures with both companies. Specialized banks, law firms, and trading companies that focused on opening the German market to U.S. capital sprang up on both sides of the Atlantic. Practically without exception, the giant U.S.-German capital flows were administered by a small group of specialists at the very top of the social structure of both countries. A number of institutions and individuals who were prominent in this trade went on to play powerful roles in U.S.-German affairs over the next five decades. Dillon Reed and Company, private U.S. investment bankers, specialized in loans to Deutsche Bank, Siemens, and Fleek interests. Between 1925 and the stock market crash in 1929, these loans amounted to more than $250 million. By the way, that was $250 million in the 1920s. That would be incalculably more today. Continuing, Friedrich Fleek built his fortune during the 1920s using bonds sold by Dillon Reed to finance what today might be called leveraged buyouts of German and Polish coal and steel companies. By the way, in a couple of half-hour segments entitled German Capital Investments or Corporate Investments in the United States, we talked about Friedrich Fleek, one of the Third Reich's most important industrialists and a convicted war criminal. He traded in at the end of World War II his exhausted mines and factories for majority ownership in the Daimler-Benz Corporation, whose board he then stocked with good, loyal Nazis. There is still major capital participation in Daimler-Benz by Friedrich Fleek, but I would note, as Daimler-Benz has now acquired the Chrysler Corporation, that Friedrich Fleek was not only a convicted war criminal, but saw to it that many unrepentant Nazis were put right back on the board of directors of the Daimler-Benz Corporation. But notice that his capital and his financial empire came from the Dillon Reed investments. Hence my emphasis over the years on what I call this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that was absolutely essential to the rise of fascism in Europe. Continuing, we're going to return now to the splendid blonde beast and note that most of the investments that took place in Europe, part of this first giant capital flow, took place in Nazi Germany, or what was soon to be Nazi Germany, and fascist Italy. Bear in mind that the companies that were the main repositories of U.S. capital were the central companies in not only financing Hitler's rise to power, but also in capitalizing and realizing German war industry. Continuing. The foreign borrowers, speaking of U.S. investment in Europe, the foreign borrowers included not only dozens of companies, but also governments as varied as Argentina, Czechoslovakia, and Denmark. However, Dulles clearly emphasized projects for Germany, for the military junta in Poland, and for Mussolini's fascist state in Italy. By the way, Poland under Marshal Pilsudski was a fascist country as well. As I mentioned, the American elite that ran Wall Street and American finance and industry, the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, had a working partnership with some of their elite compatriots who worked in the State Department. The State Department faction that we're about to look at, the so-called RIGA faction, that's spelled R-I-G-A, saw not only American capital investment in Europe, but American cooperation with Nazi Germany as essential to realizing a global anti-communist policy. This RIGA faction had much to do with the acquiescence of the United States to the rise of fascism prior to World War II and the reinstitution of those fascist elements in Germany and Italy at the end of World War II as well. Of this RIGA faction, and in particular pay attention to the name Robert Murphy, we're going to come back to that later, of this RIGA faction, the State Department compatriots of the Wall Street financial and industrial elite that we just talked about, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. The U.S. financial elite had great influence on U.S. foreign affairs, often manifested most directly in the Foreign Service, the career staff of the Department of State. As Paul Nitze's own career was to demonstrate, there was a revolving door between international service for major banks and law firms and positions in the U.S. State Department. There were many family ties, too, as when Allen Dulles remained in the Foreign Service and his brother returned to Sullivan and Cromwell. Paul Nitze, by the way, the author of NSC 68, the blueprint for U.S. waging of the Cold War, discussed in RFA 37, available from Spitfire, was a major investment banker with Dylan Reed. He later was called in by George Bush to head up the Team B analysis group that provided an altogether alarmist and exaggerated picture of Soviet intentions and capabilities in the late 1970s, which led to the election of Ronald Reagan and the huge U.S. military buildup, which bankrupted the United States in the 1980s. Skipping down, of this regifaction in the State Department, after a discussion of how members of the American elite systematically excluded people who were not members of the elite, women, blacks, and Jews, from positions of power in the Department of State, Christopher Simpson goes on to write of this regifaction, and bear in mind, again, the name Robert Murphy. We're going to come back to that later. Writing of the regifaction, Simpson says, Robert Murphy, Loy Henderson, Joseph Grew, Hugh Gibson, George Keenan, James Clement Dunn, Eldridge Dubrow, Ray Atherton, Arthur Bliss Lane, and a handful of others became the backbone of the Foreign Service, particularly in all aspects of U.S., European, and later U.S.-Soviet relations. These self-perceived, quote, realists, unquote, believed that the USSR was the most dangerous long-term rival to the U.S., and that Germany and Central Europe should be integrated into some form of cordon sanitaire against the Bolsheviks. Their analysis was rooted in what Daniel Yergin has dubbed the Rija Axioms, a collection of strongly anti-Soviet political postulates that crystallized among U.S. Foreign Service personnel during the 1920s at consulates in Riga, Latvia, Berlin, and Warsaw. The Rija Group's analysis was to have an enduring impact in escalating hostilities between the U.S. and USSR, as Yergin, Frederick Propas, Martin Weil, and others have documented. The Rija faction drew much of its most important support from the foreign policy elite outside the government. John Foster Dulles was among Rija's most articulate spokesmen, and men like James Forrestal and Paul Nitze of Dylan Reed, Charles Edward Wilson and Philip Reed of General Electric, and much of the leadership of the integrated DuPont General Motors U.S. rubber empire of that era, among others, were early supporters of the Rija postulates. By the way, bear in mind Philip Reed, we're going to come back to him later. Continuing. More to the point here, however, is the Rija Group's impact on U.S.-German relations, particularly after Hitler came to power. Perhaps the most influential proponent of the Rija axioms inside the government during the Roosevelt years was FDR's first ambassador to Moscow, William Bullitt. That's B-U-L-L-I-T-T. Continuing. He had arrived in the USSR full of enthusiasm for normalized U.S.-Soviet relations, but he left soon after convinced, quote, that only Nazi Germany could stay the advance of Soviet Bolshevism in Europe, unquote. As will be seen in a later chapter, many of the career State Department officials who were to specialize in U.S.-German relations, war crimes policy, and so-called Jewish issues, such as rescue of refugees during World War II, shared Bullitt's cynical enthusiasm for Hitler's talents. And what we're going to look at next concerns a group of, and by the way, bear in mind the Rija faction and their corresponding allies in the Wall Street financial and industrial elite. We're going to take a look at their operations during and after World War II as well, helping to restore their compatriots on the German side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. What we're going to look at now is the makeup and political and economic philosophy of some of the elite German members on the German side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. In particular, some of the captains of German finance and industry sought a corporatist policy. They, rather than following the SS paradigm of a self-sufficient German economic empire and political empire in Central and Eastern Europe, these German members of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis sought to keep Germany involved in foreign markets and sought to implement a policy of German conquest in which German arms would be seen as a vehicle for acquiring leverage for German business. And they took this corporatist philosophy as a model for German control in Europe. Of the philosophy of this corporatist faction of the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, Christopher Simpson writes as follows. In contrast, Much of the banking and industrial elite of Germany favored a more traditional imperial approach to acquiring a new empire in Europe. Among their principal spokesmen were Economics Minister Hjalmar Schacht, Hermann Obst of the Deutsche Bank, and a young Reichsbank director, Carl Blessing. Their strategy favored integrating businesses in countries occupied by the Germans into private industrial syndicates coordinated through German-based cartels and through private institutions such as Deutsche Bank. The private companies in turn pledged their loyalty to Hitler's government. German military conquest should be used to create conditions through which German corporations could buy up the key enterprises in newly subjugated countries at very favorable prices, this faction contended, but only in rare instances should the state take direct command of industry. Much of the senior leadership of the Deutsche Bank, IG Farben, the Siemens Group of Companies, and other German-based cartels maintained that Germany should re-enter the world marketplace rather than attempt to build up the orthodox Nazi dream of a self-sufficient German empire in Central and Eastern Europe. And what we're going to look at next is the second of the major capital flows that I've discussed in that we're discussing in these segments. Now, this is a major capital flow from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe into the coffers of the Third Reich. And this major capital flow, quite literally a preconceived and very effective looting of all of the liquid wealth of occupied Europe, represented the realization of this corporatist faction within the German side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and the use of bank clearing procedures and currency exchange rates in order to effect this second major capital flow, which can be conceived as going from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe, or the treasuries of the occupied nations of Europe, into the treasuries of the treasury of the Third Reich, and into the bank accounts of the major corporations that participated in the Third Reich. This is the second of these major capital flows that we're looking at in these segments. And once again, the influence and cooperation of the American end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis was absolutely central as we take a look at some of the aforementioned Dulles brothers of Sullivan and Cromwell's operations in connection with the Bank for International Settlements, or BIS. Of Alan Dulles and his attempts to whitewash German industrialists who had participated in Hitler's crimes and to indicate that they should be restored to power after World War Europe, and the influence of the Bank of Industrial Settlements on some of Dulles's judgments, Christopher Simpson writes as follows. Dulles's recently declassified OSS telegrams show that his principal sources of information on the German financial and industrial elite were officials of the Bank for International Settlements, or BIS, in Basel, Switzerland, which had worked closely with Berlin banking circles since the first years of Hitler's regime. The BIS provided sophisticated currency clearing services to a dozen industrial countries and served as a private policy council where representatives of central banks met to discuss monetary policy. As we shall see, it also represented one of the many institutions which joined together the American and German ends of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. And as we will see, the BIS was one of the major vehicles used by the Third Reich for the second major capital flow, the looting of the coffers of occupied Europe. Continuing. The Dulles family had played an important role in the bank from its inception, so it was not surprising that Alan Dulles would turn to his contacts there. The institution had been founded to carry out the international clearing necessary for the reparations programs John Foster Dulles had helped pioneer after World War I, and the bank's first chronicler and most enthusiastic supporter was his sister, Eleanor Lansing Dulles. Both Alan and John Foster Dulles sat on the boards of New York and London affiliates of European companies led by men on the BIS board of directors, and an American with long social and business ties to the Dulleses, Thomas McKittrick, became president of the BIS in 1940. And, skipping down, notwithstanding the fact that McKittrick was its president, the BIS was thoroughly dominated by Axis interests due to bank bylaws that allocated votes on bank policy according to financial contributions. Axis powers had controlled a plurality of BIS votes throughout the 1930s, and as the Blitzkrieg progressed, control of more central banks fell into German hands. By the end of 1942, Germany and the Axis controlled more than 75% of the votes on the BIS board. The BIS remained officially neutral, But as a practical matter, its allegiance has shifted with the fortunes of war. During McKittrick's presidency, the BIS cooperated with the German Reichsbank's efforts to launder gold stolen from the mouths of death camp victims, in part because German Finance Minister Walter Funk was first among equals on the BIS's wartime board of directors. The institution also joined in a complex Nazi scheme to use currency manipulation and bank clearing procedures to loot the economies of entire countries. Now, in the strategy that I'm about to detail, we can see the realization of the corporatist strategy that was favored by some of the key German members of the German end of this transatlantic financial industrial axis, namely using German arms in order to conquer countries whose economies could then be restructured in a manner favorable to the occupying Germans. And this constitutes the second major capital flow, namely the looting of the coffers of the occupied nations. Continuing. Both programs led to charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Germans involved in the scheme. McKittrick and other BIS executives, however, were never charged. The bank clearing schemes deserve special notice because of their significant but little-known role in looting the equivalent of billions of dollars from Nazi-occupied territories. Importantly, this form of looting was, for the most part, organized and managed by ordinary German corporate executives and their foreign collaborators, not by the SS or die-hard Nazis. Here again, the Nazis succeeded in harnessing the in-place, more or less conventional social machinery of trade to the tasks of the Hitler government. In this way, billions of Reichsmarks worth of wealth in the countries occupied by the Nazis shifted into German hands, often before the victimized country even understood what was happening. Germany had instituted basic monetary clearing procedures during the 1930s as a means of controlling the flow of foreign currencies in and out of the Reich. In its simplest form, a German company interested in trade with, say, Belgium would pay for Belgian goods in German currency to the German central bank, the Reichsbank in Berlin. The Reichsbank would send what amounted to an international IOU to the Belgian central bank for the amount it had been paid by the German company. The Belgian central bank would then pay the Belgian company the money for its goods in Belgian currency. Hundreds of other companies in many countries were involved in thousands of similar deals. Then, at regular intervals, the central bank would meet at the BIS, total up the credits and debits of all the business deals, and clear them by making a settlement between central banks that balanced their accounts. The creation of this central channel for foreign exchange permitted Hitler's government to monitor and license most transactions between Germans and foreigners. These procedures contributed significantly to the Aryanization of Jewish property because they closed off opportunities to transfer assets abroad for all but a handful of the wealthiest and best-connected German Jews. During Germany's wartime occupation of foreign countries, Hitler's government took effective control of both sides of the clearing equation and thus could manipulate each contract to its advantage. German bankers took over most of the central banks in the occupied countries, staffing those institutions with German professionals and compliant foreigners. We're going to take a look at the further development of this policy in our second half-hour segment. That concludes this half-hour. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. You're listening to The Month of Mayhem, Memorial Day weekend, Uncle Sam and the Swastika special, detailing the collaboration between U.S. corporations and the fascist powers of World War II. We're going to continue with the next half-hour side of tonight's program, today's program, the Sunday, May 30th program, a nice chunk of the day anyway. This is from the For the Record segment entitled Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow. And we're going to get right to the concluding half-hour sod, which is, of course, a half-hour in length for those of you who are taping. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment, we're going to continue with an examination of some of the major 20th century capital flows, which not only led to the growth and establishment of fascism in Europe in the pre-World War II period, but which have also manifested themselves in the post-World War II period in such a way as to revive fascism, or perhaps perpetuate fascism would be a better term. And I'm going into these capital flows in part to provide some understanding for some of the things that I've been speaking about in recent months, in particular the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, and also the Nazi book Serpent's Walk about the SS going underground, building up their economic muscle, taking over the U.S. opinion-forming media, infiltrating the U.S. Army, and after an attack by genetically engineered viruses of ostensible Russian origin. The SS then, which those attacks, by the way, kill the president and vice president. The SS then takes over the United States, courtesy of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who is a Nazi ally. I've gone into both the Bormann Organization and the book Serpent's Walk in past half-hour segments. We're going to turn once again for our discussion of the second of the major capital flows that we're talking about, namely the flow of capital from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe during World War II into the coffers of the Third Reich. The second major capital flow was accomplished by the Nazis utilizing bank clearing and currency rate exchange mechanisms. And one of the key institutions involved with this was the Bank for International Settlements, staffed in considerable measure by some of the American branch, the American participants in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. We're going to turn once again to the book The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson that we were using in the first half-hour segment. Of these complicated bank clearing procedures and exchange rate mechanisms that were used by the Third Reich to loot the coffers of the occupied countries of Europe, the second of the major capital flows that we're looking at, Simpson writes as follows. In Belgium, for example, the Nazi occupation government declared the German currency, the Reichsmark, to be worth 12.5 Belgian francs. This rate overvalued the mark by as much as 50%, making everything in Belgium extraordinarily cheap for Germans. Next, the puppet Belgian government decreed that all trade with Germany or with the occupation government was required to use a special currency designed for German use in the occupied countries. In effect, Germany created a new type of money in Belgium, and throughout Nazi-occupied Europe that it could print and spend at will. When it came time to settle up between the Reichsbank and the Foreign Central Bank, the Reichsbank again enlisted the cooperation of the Bank for International Settlements in putting forward a variety of pretexts not to pay its debt. The occupied country was powerless to resist. Skipping down, soon German banks and companies began buying up foreign companies, real estate, products and raw materials all across Europe for a fraction of their value. Such transactions were usually completed, quote, legally, unquote, with all of the contracts, deeds, and other documentation typical of conventional business. Meanwhile, those aspects of the economies in the occupied countries that were not dependent upon sales to Germany disintegrated. This was extremely profitable for the German companies, of course, and presented a major inducement for some business people to collaborate with the occupation. The post-war coalition government in Poland estimated that this type of theft had cost their country the equivalent of 20 billion marks between 1939 and 1945, equal to about 17% of Germany's total annual war budget at the height of the conflict in Europe. While these numbers are an estimate, and the Polish government obviously had an interest in claiming a high level of damages, they nonetheless illustrate the effectiveness of this technique of draining wealth from occupied countries. A study by the British Ministry of Economic Warfare reported damages consistent with the Polish estimates and roughly proportionate figures for eight other countries occupied by Germany. In all, the British estimated that the Germans had extracted the equivalent of about $180 billion from occupied Europe as of 1943, including both direct levies for occupation costs and a variety of hidden techniques such as currency manipulation. These figures were based on financial statistics published by the Germans themselves and do not include estimates for wealth seized from the USSR and Greece. As such, even the $180 billion figure clearly underestimates the true total. And that, of course, was only up to 1943. Continuing, the Bank for International Settlements cooperated with and facilitated this scheme despite protests from exiled Allied governments. The bank recognized the Nazi-installed occupation governments provided the clearing services essential to, quote, legalizing, unquote, the operation, and even went so far as to help Nazi leaders such as Walter Funk unload looted gold in international markets. And so that is the second of the major capital flows, the first one being a major capital flow from the booming U.S. of the 1920s to Europe and Germany in particular to build up the industry that not only was the backbone of Hitler's war-making capacity, but which elevated Hitler to power in the first place. As the war began to go badly for Germany, one of the things that I talked about in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program alluded to earlier, namely the Himmlerkreis or Himmler's Circle of Friends, key German industrialists whose contributions financed the day-to-day operations of the SS and who in turn got the pick of the SS slave labor pool to use in their industrial operations. The Himmlerkreis, who embodied many of the industrialists who formulated the policy that was realized with the looting scheme that I just detailed, namely using German arms to conquer countries, which would then have their economies restructured in such a way as to favor German corporate interests, who would then re-enter the world market. Many of these same industrialists and these corporatists that I alluded to earlier, and whose strategy and the realization of whose strategy I just talked about, were key members of the Himmlerkreis, and they in turn began putting together bodies which began actively collaborating that actively cooperated with the American branch or members of the American branch of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis to perpetuate the German industrial elite after World War II. Christopher Simpson writes about this in The Splendid Blonde Beast as follows. The notorious Himmlerkreis, the circle of friends of Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler, is a good example of the dynamics of Germany's high-level business networks during the decline of the Third Reich. The Nazis and leading German businessmen had jointly created the Himmlerkreis in the early 1930s as an informal communication link between the financial and industrial elite and the SS. Himmler sought the political and economic support of the business elite, and the elite in turn sought influence outside of official channels with the increasingly powerful police leader, skipping down. As the SS grew as an economic power, the SS members of the Himmlerkreis often migrated to new positions on corporate boards where they could secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the regime. SS men and Nazi Party activists who made this transition included Wilhelm Kepler of the BRABAG Brown Coal Combine and SS Enterprises, Fritz Kronefuss, BRABAG Dresdner Bank, and Ritter von Holt, who joined the Deutsche Bank board. Officially, the Himmlerkreis meetings were not for conducting business, because that would have suggested corruption in National Socialist circles. As a practical matter, however, the encounter served as an informal coordinating point for German industry's negotiations with the SS on policy matters. IG Farben appears to have used Himmlerkreis meetings to seek support for the company's vast forced labor complex at Auschwitz, for example. The companies represented in Himmler's circle became pacesetters in Aryanization, exploitation of concentration camp labor, seizure of foreign companies in the occupied territories, and similar business ventures that depended on SS cooperation. But as the war turned against the Third Reich, a number of business leaders in the Himmlerkreis began to cooperate in clandestine and semi-clandestine contingency planning for the post-war period. Two of the best known of these groups, the Arbeitskreis für Außenwirtschaftliche Fragen, the Working Group for Foreign Economic Questions, and the Kleiner Arbeitskreis, or Small Working Group, were nominally sponsored by the Reichsgruppe Industrie Association of Major Industrial and Financial Companies. They brought together Blessing, Rasche, Kurt von Schroeder, Lindemann, and others from the Himmlerkreis, with other business people such as Hermann Obbs of the Deutsche Bank, Ludwig Erhard, then an economist with the Reichsgruppe Industrie and later Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor, Ludger Westrich, RKG Aluminum Industry and Non-Ferrous Metals, and Philip Reimstra, Tobacco, Shipping, and Banking, with Nazi business specialists such as Otto Ohlendorf, the former commander of the Einsatzgruppe D murder troops, and Hans Kerl, SS business specialist. By the way, take note of one of the key participants in the Himmlerkreis groups that Chris Simpson's talking about here, namely Ludwig Erhard. He was not only Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor and the economic minister of Adenauer's Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany. He later succeeded Adenauer as Chancellor of Germany and was the key architect of post-war German economic recovery. And note his position here working with the Himmlerkreis. Continuing. A half dozen similar business forums emerged during the last years of the Third Reich. Most of these overlapped in membership, and all of them favored some variation of the corporatist strategy for empire articulated by Hjalmar Schacht, OBS, and others during the showdown over Aryanization in Vienna discussed earlier. By the way, that corporatist policy for conquest was realized in the second major capital flow, the looting of the coffers of occupied nations that we just discussed.